Chapter 3. The Arrival. River Journey. Shining in Swiftness was the name of the boat on which the Ishmaelites embarked with their animals, after providing themselves from the booths at the landing place with food for 9 days' travel. The name was written on both sides of its goose-head prow, and the empty boat was characteristic of the country, for it was the clumsiest freighter to be found anywhere on Menfe's landing places, with a bellying hold built for cargo space, latticed wooden weatherboards, a cabin consisting only of a mat-covered shelter opening forward, and a tiny but very heavy rudder fastened perpendicularly to a pole at the stern. The pilot was named Thotnofer. He was a man from the north, in earrings, with white hair on head and breast. The old man had made his acquaintance at the hostel, and covenanted with him for a cheap passage. Thotnofer's ship carried lumber, one bale of royal and one of coarse linen, papyrus, neat skins, ship's rope, 20 sacks of lentils, and 30 casks of dried fish. Shining in Swiftness also had on board the portrait statue of a rich burgher of Thebes, standing quite forward at the peak, done up in slats and sacking. It was for the good house, in other words, for the grave, of the man who had ordered it west of the river. It would be set up as issuing from an imitation door to behold his everlasting goods and the representations of his daily life painted on the walls. To be sure, the eyes by which he might do this were not yet set, the figure was not yet colored with the tints of life, and the stick was lacking that should go through the fist extended along the slantwise front of his projecting skirt. But its model had set store by having at least his double chin and his thick legs executed in the rough under the eyes of Ptah and by the hand of Ptah's artists. The last touches might be given in some workshop in Thebes, the city of the dead. At midday, the crew untied the ship from the pile and raised the patched brown sail, which at once filled with the strong north wind. The pilot, sitting on the slanting beak in the stern of the boat, began to operate the rudder with the perpendicular lever. A man at the goosehead in the prow tested the channel with a pole, while Thotnofer, the shipmaster, propitiated the gods by burning in front of the cabin some of the resin with which the Ishmaelites had paid their fares. Thus the boat bearing Joseph moved upstream, curving fore and aft and cutting the water only with the middle of her keel, while the old man, sitting with his party on the lumber piled behind the cabin, extended himself in observations on the wisdom of life. How almost always the advantages so equalized and cancelled each other that the result was a moderate perfection, not too good and not too bad. Thus one travelled upstream against the current, but on the other hand the wind came regularly from the north and swelled the sail to advantage, so that the two contrary forces resulted in moderate progress. Of course it was all very fine sailing downstream, for one could let oneself be borne by it, but it was easy for the boat to get out of hand. It might go crosswise of the stream and give no end of trouble with the steering to avoid accidents. Thus, in life, the advantages were always balanced by the disadvantages, and vice versa. And the result, mathematically, might seem to be nil, but in practice it was a wise balance and an average felicity, in view of which neither jubilation nor cursing, but real satisfaction was in place. For perfection consisted not in one-sided heaping up of advantages until life became impossible on the other. Rather, it consisted in the mutual cancellation of disadvantage and advantage, and the result was called contentment. So the old man, with uplifted finger and head on one side. His people listened open-mouthed, but exchanged abashed and sulky looks, as ordinary people do when listening unwillingly to the claims of the higher life. Nor did Joseph give more than half an ear to the old man's prosing, for he was rejoicing in the new experience of the water journey, the fresh wind, the melodious chuckling of the waves against the bow, the gentle rocking and gliding on the wide river, whose tide came sparkling toward him as once to Eliezer the earth upon his travels. The shore afforded a changing succession of gay or luxuriant or sacred scenes. Pillared halls often stood on the banks, sometimes with palm groves before them, but just as often stone roads built by men, belonging to the temples of the city. Villages glided past, with high dovecotes and green orchards. And again, gay and splendid cities, with spires glittering golden to the sun, and pennanted gates. Pairs of statues of enormous size sat stately and rigid with their hands on their knees, and gazed from the bank across the river and the land into the desert. Sometimes it was all quite close, and then far away. For they moved at times in the center of a river whose waters had widened to a lake, or again, wound in curves behind which new scenes of Egypt unfolded. But life on the sacred river itself, the great highway of Egypt, was hugely diverting. How many sails, fine and coarse, swelled in the wind! How many rudders stemmed themselves in its flood! The carrying air was full of voices, the jokes and halloos of sailors, the warning cries of the polesmen at the prow as the boat approached eddies and sandbanks, the chanting calls of seamen on the cabin roofs to sailors and pilots below. Common boats like Thotnofer's there were in hordes, but also fine, slender barks met and hailed, shining in swiftness, or overtook her. They were painted blue, with a short mast and a broad, dove-colored sail, which bellied in a charming swell. Their beaks were shaped like the lotus flower, and they had dainty pavilions instead of a rude board cabin. The temple barks had purple sails and large pictures painted on the side. The private yachts of the great and mighty boasted 12 oarsmen on a side, and on the deck a pillared pleasure house with the owner's luggage and chariot stowed on the roof. Its walls were formed by splendid carpets, and in it sat the lordly owner, hands in his lap, fixed, as it were, congealed in beauty and richness, and looking neither right nor left. They even met a funeral procession of 3 ships fastened together, and on the rear one, a white bark without rudder or sail, the bright-colored Osiris, head to the prow, lay amongst his mourners on a lion-footed bier. Yes, there was much to see on river and shore. Joseph, on whom the joys of a water journey had never smiled before, on such a one as this now found the days pass like hours. He was to grow used indeed to this kind of travel, and to this very stretch between Amun's house and grave, jesting Menphe. Very like these mighty ones in their carpet-hung chapels, he himself would one day sit, with the prescribed and stately immobility which he would have to learn because the common folk expected it from gods and great ones. For he was to bear himself so shrewdly, and prove himself so skilled in his dealings with God, as to become the first among those of the West, and entitled to sit there looking neither right nor left. This was reserved for him. But meanwhile, he looked right and left all he could round about in the land and the life of the land, to take it into his spirit and senses, always mindful lest his curiosity should express itself in amazement and futility, instead of keeping a certain due and blithe reserve for the Father's sake. Thus the evening and morning were another day, and so the days increased. Menphe lay behind them, and the day when they sailed hence. The sun sank down, the desert distance turned violet blue. The Arabian sky on their left gave back a softened glow from the extravagant orange of the western Libyan sky. Where they found themselves at nightfall, they tied up and slept, to float on next day. The wind favored them, with exception of the days when it fell. Then they had to row, and the slave, Usarsif, also the younger Ishmaelites, helped at the oars, for the boat had no large crew, and Thotnofer was anxious not to lose time, for he had promised to deliver the statue by a certain date. They were, in fact, not greatly delayed, for when the wind blew, it filled the sails the fuller, and thus advantage and disadvantage were resolved in satisfaction. On the 9th evening, they saw some jagged heights rising rosy and translucent in the distance. They looked like red corundum, and very beautiful, though, as everyone knew, they were barren and accursed, like all the mountains of Egypt. The pilot and the old man recognized them as Amun's mountains, the heights of No, and when they had slept and sailed again, and even taken in sheer impatience to the oars, at last they saw it. It came nearer, Pharaoh's famous city, glittering with gold, greeting their eyes with shimmering rainbow colors. They entered it while still on the boat and without going on shore, for the river became a splendid boulevard and flowed between rows of celestial structures, of temples and palaces, amid green gardens of delight. All this, both right and left, on the shore of life as well as on the shore of death. There were papyrus colonnades and lotus colonnades, gold-tipped obelisks, colossal statues, turreted gates with sphinx avenues leading to them from the bank. Their doors and flagpoles were gilded, and light flashed from them that dazzled the eyes, till the painted scenes and inscriptions on the buildings, the cinnamon red, the plum color, the emerald green, the ochre yellow, and the azure blue, all swam together into one confused sea of color. "That is Ipet Isowet, Amun's great house," said the old man to Joseph, pointing with his finger. "It has a hall 50 ells wide, with 52 columns and pillars like tent poles, and the hall itself, if it please thee, is paved with silver." "Surely it pleaseth me," Joseph answered. "I knew, of course, that Amun is a very rich god." "Those are the shipyards of the god," said the old man again, pointing to the basins and dry docks on the left, where numerous apron-wearers, the god's carpenters, were at work with drills, hammers, and picks on skeletons of ships. "There is Pharaoh's temple of the dead, and there his house of life," said he, and pointed here and there westwards into the land to various blocks of buildings in character both magnificent and charming at once. "That is Amun's southern house of women," turning toward the other side to point out an expanse of temple precincts on the bank. The sun glared against their facades. The shadows cast by their projections were sharp and black. Hordes of men were bustling about, engaged in building activities. "Dost thou see this beauty? Dost thou see the shrine of the mystery of the kingly conception? Dost thou see where Pharaoh buildeth another hall in front of the hall and the court, with taller columns than all the rest? That, my friend, is Noet Amun, the proud, which we see. Observe, then, the Ram Avenue that runneth from the southern house of women to the great house. 5,000 ells long is it, let me tell thee, bordered right and left with Amun rams bearing Pharaoh's image between their legs." "All very nice," said Joseph. "Nice!" said the old man, firing up. "Thou choosest me words out of the treasury of speech so inept as to be comic, I must say. Thou hast pleased me little indeed with thy response to the marvels of Weset." "I did say very nice," replied Joseph. "As nice as thou wilt. But where is the house of the fan-bearer before which thou wilt bring me? Canst thou show it to me from here?"
"No, that one cannot make out from here," responded the elder. "It lieth toward the western desert, where the city thinneth out, losing itself in villas and lordly gardens."
"And wilt thou take me even to-day before the house?"
"Thou canst not well expect that I shall take thee thither and sell thee. Dost thou know, then, that the steward of the house will take thee, and offer enough for thee that I am paid for my outgo, and get a little just profit therefrom? It is some changes of the moon since I released thee out of thy mother the well, and some days that thou hast baked me pancakes, and fetched new words out of thy storehouse to wish me good night, so that it may be the time has grown long to thee, and thou weariest of us, and would seek new service. Yet it might as well have been that the many days had made habit with thee, so that thou couldst not lightly part from thy rescuer, the old Menean from Ma'on, but be content to wait the hour till he goeth away and leaveth thee in the hands of strangers. Either of these might issue out of the many days of our wandering together."
"The latter," answered Joseph. "Quite incontestably the latter is the reality. Of a surety I am in no haste to part from thee, my deliverer. My only haste is that I may arrive whither God will have me.
Content thyself, replied the old man. We will land and submit ourselves to the troublesome formalities which the children of Egypt lay upon us, and which will take a long time. After that we will go to a hostel that I know in the city's heart, and there spend the night. But tomorrow I will bring thee before the house of blessing, and offer thee to my friend, the house steward, Montcalm.
While they were talking, they had come to port, or rather to the place where the boat should tie up, crossing over from the middle of the stream, while Thotnofer burned more balsam in front of the cabin as a thank-offering for their safe journey. The landing was as troublesome and time-consuming as only such journeys anywhere ever were or are. They came into the noise and bustle of the landing stage and the water in front of it, where there was a congestion of ships, native and foreign, either already tied up or looking for a landing place to fling their rope when a post was free. Shining in swiftness was docked by the port authorities and customs officials, who began to make entries of great and small, of mice and men, and every piece of freight. While on shore, the servants of the owner of the statue stretched out their arms and shrieked their demands for its delivery. There were many peddlers of sandals, caps, and honey cakes. Their cries mingled with the bleating of herds being unshipped close by, and the music of jugglers trying to call attention to themselves on the quay. It was a vast confusion. Joseph and his companions sat still and shrinking on the lumber at the stern of their boat, and awaited the moment when they could get off and seek their hostel. But it was still remote. The old man had to come before the customs in person, to vouch for himself and each of his party, and pay the harbor dues for his wares. He was shrewd enough to establish human relations instead of official ones, so that the authorities laughed and joked, accepted small presents, and were not too precise about the landing rules for stranger merchants. A few hours after they had tied up, the owners of Joseph were able to lead their camels across the gangplank, and, quite unnoticed by a crowd used to the sight of any and every complexion and costume, to make their way through the mingled tumult of the port quarter. Joseph goes through Waysay. The Egyptian city, whose name the Greeks later adapted for their own convenience, and called it Thebae, was, when Joseph landed and lived there, by no means at the height of its fame, although already famous, as can be gathered from the way the Ishmaelites spoke of it, and the feelings Joseph entertained when he found himself at his journey's end. From dark and small beginnings in the long ago, it had waxed and was on the way to full splendor. Yet much still lacked before its glory was complete and it paused perfected, one of the seven wonders of the world. It was this as a whole, but also and indeed principally in one of its parts, the unique and marvelous vast columned hall which a later pharaoh, named Ramesu, or the Sun Hath Begotten Him, added to the group of buildings which composed the great Amun temple in the north, at an expense commensurate with the renown of the god. Of this hall, then, Joseph's eyes beheld as little as they had of the departed glories in the environs of the pyramids, only on contrary grounds. The hall had not yet achieved any presentness, and no one had yet had courage to imagine it. To make it possible, something had to precede it, which then, as men tired of it, and it could no longer satisfy their difficult imaginations, would be superseded by something else. There was, for instance, the silver-paved hall of Epet-Isoet, built by the three predecessors of the present god. The old man knew it, with its 52 columns like tent poles. Or there was the hall which Pharaoh himself, as Joseph had seen, was having added to Amun's southern house of women, the beautiful temple on the river. It excelled all the rest. And this beauty must first be imagined, and then realized, in the faith that it was the uttermost man could perform, before man's insatiable imagination could use it as a springboard for the actually uttermost, the unsurpassable beauty of a final achievement. In other words, the wonder of the world, the great hall of Ramesses. This, then, in Joseph's and our time, was not yet present, but only, as it were, on the way. Nonetheless, Waset, also called Noet Amun, chief city on the River Nile,
was even at this time a marvel to all the world, both near and far, wherever it was known. Report even exaggerated the marvel, making it a point of honor and a convention, as men love to do, if only by hearsay, so that a man would have been looked at askance and considered outside the pale who had dared to doubt in public that No, in the land of Egypt, was beautiful beyond word or measure, the abstract of all architectural magnificence, and simply a dream of a city.